dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Hey folks, it's Jim Hansen sitting in for Frank today doing Secure Freedom Radio. We're going to talk a little bit today about America reasserting ourselves. President Trump has swept onto the world stage like the new sheriff in a Western movie who pushes through the saloon doors and stares down the surly and out-of-control clientele. He eyeballs the bad guys until he sees the one who is going to be the example. Then he sweeps his coat back behind his holster and dares the guy to draw. Now, of course, the villain goes for his gun, but our guy draws faster and ventilates him. Then he looks around the rest of that Star Wars cantina that is this planet and says, "Yeah, I will shoot first. Anybody else want to try me?" And suddenly, the rest of the bar decides maybe they're more interested in playing poker or dancing girls or anything other than being the next victim. Now, I'm not the fanboy type or simply dazzled by Trump, but I will surely say that I'm more than a little pleased to see some backbone back in our foreign policy. The bad guys have been running rampant for far too long. And they needed a reminder that America is the biggest dog on the porch. Bullies and tyrants feed off weakness, and they have been gorging themselves at the all-you-can-eat buffet that was Obama's please-don't-hurt-us policy. The current conflagrations around the planet are the natural result of putting the world's most successful beta male in charge of the security of the free world. Now, our current commander-in-chief has moved from leading from behind to putting the world on notice that their days of free reign to rape, kill, pillage, and burn are over. And there is a price that bad actors will pay for acting bad. So let's take a quick look at a few of the hot spots that are getting a dose of this fire hose. Now, it's hardly shocking to point out that nuclear weapons are dangerous, and that in a perfect world, crazy people would not have them. We obviously do not live in a perfect world. And a perfect example of that is the current loon running North Korea, Kim Jong-un. He is the third in this line of tyrants, and by all accounts, the craziest of the lot. Not good. Add to that the fact that he has nuclear weapons and is working harder and harder to build ways to get them all the way here, or at least to California, or maybe Hawaii, and you have a horrible situation. And he is absolutely bat guano crazy, in the way only the son of a dictator who was crazy himself can be. You know, when you grow up watching your dad slaughter his political enemies in horrifyingly creative ways and have virtually zero controls put on you, you get a guy who now occasionally kills those who displease them by firing squad, except using an anti-aircraft gun to do the deed. Now, historically, the Chinese have used North Korea as a tool to keep us off balance. They would let whichever Kim was currently running that hellhole rattle some sabers and force us to come to the table and take our eye off of other things to pay some sort of bribe to stop him from doing something, well, crazy. Now we're at the point where all of those payments of Kim Geld have stopped nothing, especially their nuke program. And now the current chubby Kim is so far around the bend, even the Chinese have basically had enough. They have always been the main enabler by giving them just barely enough food and energy to keep their prison industrial complex churning out badness while grinding its people to dust. But now it seems even their patience and his usefulness are not in balance anymore. Now that's a problem for China, and for us, and for the rest of the world, because as I mentioned, the deranged dictator has nukes. The policy to deal with North Korea during the Obama years was called strategic patience. That's just a lame euphemism for whistling past the graveyard, hoping nothing bad happens while you're in office. It was an un-policy. Now, I have some sympathy for Obama on this particular account. Most of his feckless kowtowing to tyrants and cringing capitulation was simply his "can't we all just get along" nature. Consequently, getting punked by every two-bit dictator on the planet. But there really has been no real good answer to North Korea since they went nuclear. By the way, thanks to a deal Bill Clinton made, and which Obama used as the roadmap for his Iran deal. So we can expect the mullahs to have nukes sometime soon as well. But once there was an active nuclear threat from Pyongyang, it severely limited our options. However, that doesn't mean that being strategically patient helps in the slightest. So President Trump had a chat with the Chinese leaders about this, and he also sent a 90,000-ton message in the form of the USS Carl Vinson carrier to the Norks saying, "Look, fellas, you are starting to make me angry, and you won't like me when I'm angry." And if they want to know who they can ask about that, they can talk to Bashar al-Assad in Syria, who also got a dose of tough medicine. Assad punked Obama by wiping out a bunch of his people with a chemical attack. But when he tried the same thing with Trump, there was a rain of tomahawks from the sky as the red line Obama slunk away from was enforced. Now, this was also a message to Vlad Putin, saying that your puppets must not make messes that we have to clean up. And President Trump was also nice enough to give the Russians a heads up so we could avoid casualties that might have led to an escalation with them. Both of those messages were well crafted for the audiences intended, and while they're not likely to be the last word we have, we now have a completely different conversation going on. It's fair to say we got their attention. Then there was the deployment of the mother of all bombs to vaporize an entire infestation of ISIS scum in Afghanistan. Now, this was only one nest, and maybe 100-plus of the vermin total, but the message was unmistakable. Nowhere to run to, nowhere to hide. You can dig a hole in the most remote places on Earth, but we will come find you and turn your world into a firestorm, destroying you and everything you built. Because as we know, rubble doesn't make trouble. Now again, this was not a solution to ISIS, even to ISIS in Afghanistan. But it was an exclamation point on the statement, "You are not free to act as enemies of all mankind. We will stop you in the most painful and devastating way possible." That is the first step toward a policy of peace through strength, as advocated and demonstrated by President Reagan. You have to prove you are willing to use force if needed, and then you must build and maintain a credible force that serves as the iron fist in the velvet glove of your diplomacy. Or in the case of President Trump, in your art of the deal. Diplomacy works so much better when the bad guys believe that their best chance to avoid becoming a stain on the ground lies in making a deal with us. President Trump took this first step in reasserting the United States' proper place in the world order, number one top dog, by taking down some well-deserving evildoers. I have no doubt that's changed some of their cunning plans. I'm Jim Hansen. If you enjoyed this little chat, you'd probably like my Twitter feed. You can find me there at @Uncle_Jimbo. Up next, after the break, we'll be talking with Tom Rogan of National Review about how President Trump's new policy of facing down the tyrants of the world is actually working. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. We're going to talk right now with Tom Rogan, who is a columnist for National Review, as well as a senior fellow at the Steamboat Institute. And Tom, you tend to keep an eye on the larger geopolitical game. Obviously, Trump hit Assad's airfield in Syria, the one the chemical strikes came from, steamed a carrier group, or at least turned one around and aimed it back at North Korea. Then we've got a little bit of craziness going on in Turkey now with Erdogan having a referendum to essentially turn him into more of a dictator than he already is. And I just wondered what your overall view is. Are we more in a more dangerous place than we were before, or potentially are we pushing things the right direction?
I think we're pushing things in the right direction. And I say that as someone who, you know, remains some degree skeptical of the president on issues like Russia, for example. But I do think if you look at objectively at what he has done in the last 2 or 3 weeks in delivering American credibility to the Middle East, where it has sorely been missed, and in so winning the support of European allies, in the Pacific, pushing China towards a position where they are at least making concessions they have not made for a large number of years. And then finally, in the sense of North Korea, altering the regime's language. And this hasn't been talked about a lot, but if you look at what the North Korean political officers have been saying in recent days, it has changed from we're preparing to annihilate the evil Yankee, blah, 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 to if America attacks, we will annihilate thee.
Now, that's a dangerous game, obviously. You know, when you're dealing with someone as unstable as Kim, and in this case, his handlers in China, it's kind of a double-edged sword. You have to deal with the Chinese, and if Trump has success there, potentially he can gain their help in dealing with North Korea, but you still have the instability of a guy who is the craziest in the line of Kim's. And if that moderates, that would somewhat, you know, validate the idea that you can come to peace through strength. And hopefully, you know, I guess my hope would be that Trump can demonstrate this in as few ways as possible in order to reap the rewards. And if, as you mentioned, that's already happening in North Korea, that's a good thing. Is that potentially something that can spread to some of the other tyrants we're jousting with?
Yeah, I think so, and I hope so. And look, if Trump is looking for a doctrine, what he's doing at the moment is very good in the sense that it's not, you know, neoconservative, but it's not the acquiescence or appeasement of the Obama administration. It's hard-headed realism. It's realism for a tough world that stands up for American interests, but American interests bound up in terms of, you know, our interest in maintaining a degree of international stability and order. So I hope that he continues on that basis. And if he does, I think you will continue to see from regimes like China and North Korea, and hopefully from the Russians, a sense of American leadership that they cannot ignore and must become malleable to, in the sense that President Obama was malleable to their interests. Now they can become malleable to us, because in all this, you are seeing the proof that rational actors are still aware that the United States is the world's preeminent power and that they do not want to get on the bad side of the United States, or certainly not the American president.
Now, you mentioned Russia is the one where we're dealing a very complicated situation, and Syria, you know, showed that in spades. We actually apparently warned the Russians that we were going to hit that airbase. and let them potentially move their people away and give them a warning that this is not a good idea. Do you think that's a way he can actually engage with them in a from a position of strength as opposed to weakness?
Yes, and he, you know, that was obviously important to do because that would have served no one's interest if Russians had been killed in that incident, or certainly would have been very risky in terms of American strategic interest. But the Russia is to come to a position where, you know, from my point of view, Assad goes. I think he has to go if you're going to ever deal with ISIS because of his role as a bannerman for ISIS recruitment and Salafi jihadist recruitment. But also to say to the Russians, you're going to have a huge say, perhaps the primary say, on who would replace them. And you're also going to be able to keep your bases at the Takir and Tartus. And you're going to be able to be consolidated in terms of your mercantilist relationships with the existing regime. So if he's able to do that and say, listen, but our concern here is just getting a situation that dilutes the civil war, that brings it into a position of, you know, relative peace, and relative being the operative word there. And then, you know, that is the way to go. The question is, does Putin see enough pressure from the United States towards doing that? And I think you'll see in the next few weeks, probably Assad using chemical weapons again to try and test through the Russians, or on the request of the Russians, try and test how the United States responds. And that'll be a critical moment.
Wow, that could get a little interesting. Folks, we're talking with Tom Rogan, columnist for National Review. Now, let's stay in the region. There was a referendum of sorts, I guess. You know, people voted, and then Erdogan controlled who counted the votes. And shockingly, he won huge new powers and has consolidated his ability to reign as dictator there. We kind of need his help in finishing up what's going on with ISIS and Assad and the rest. They have, you know, obviously a great stake, Turkey does, in how that all plays out in the end. And it also seemed like President Trump extended something of an olive branch toward Erdogan today in talking about the referendum. Is Erdogan somebody we can deal with? I've always had a considerable concern about him.
Yeah, there is. And I think the concern is rightful. But, you know, we also need to be in a position where, with Erdogan, that we are producing a effect in terms of, you know, Trump was right, for example, to congratulate him on his win, even if that, you know, in terms of the referendum, even if that was not necessarily democratically robust. But the key to Erdogan, I think, is to let him know that he can't have his cake and eat it in the sense of NATO. He can't be a NATO member with all the benefits that accrues with access to the United States, with an alliance with the United States, if he's also, you know, playing up to the Russian orbit in Syria, which he increasingly has been doing, and conducting over time this usurpation of power. So if we see, for example, more arrests of, you know, activists, democratic activists in Turkey, that would be a point for Trump to say, you've got to cut this out, because you can't have, if you care about these mutual interests, you cannot keep doing this.
Can we count on that, though? Because he's been pushing the Islamist line for a while now. I know that the Trump administration has somewhat mitigated its counter-Islamist moves recently, you know, with Flynn leaving and McMaster and Mattis showing a little bit more tolerance that direction. Can we afford to have Turkey pushing a very strong Islamist line and also inside our tent with NATO?
Well, the operative factor is going to be whether we have a situation in which, what does he do next in policy terms? So he keeps doing what he's doing. I think his days in NATO have to be numbered, you know, to be blunt. I mean, I had a piece at NR talking about some of the ways we can pressure him, you know, through the Kurds, you know, which is an obvious pressure point, but also that NATO involvement, his interest in future trading relationships. The European Union, I think, is probably gone for him, and I think he's probably aware of that. There are ways to exert pressure on the Turkish presidency, per se, that allow, I think, you know, at least the opportunity, the potential to bring him back away from some of the more extreme elements. But the function is, Turkey is an important actor. You know, in realism, we have an interest in dealing with them. But we have to define what is tolerable to us in terms of activity.
Well, Tom Rogan, let's hope that President Trump is able to continue at least cashing in some chips in this high-stakes poker game. Folks, we've been talking with Tom Rogan. Thank you so much, and we'll have you on again soon. Up after the break, we will talk with Patrick Dunleavy.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It's Jim Hansen sitting in for Frank, and we're going to talk right now with Patrick Dunleavy, who is former Deputy Inspector General for the New York State Department of Corrections, author of the book The Fertile Soil of Jihad, Terrorism's Prison Connection, and currently a senior fellow with the Investigative Project on Terrorism. And Patrick, it's terrorism and our inability to deal with it in any logical way that I want to start off with you. There was an article in the New York Post just yesterday from Paul Sperry, who does tremendous work on this, and who quoted a gentleman named Patrick Dunleavy about what happened in New York City with a settlement that was made with CARE and some other Islamist groups that removed from use a report on how radicalization occurs. And near as I can tell, it was removed because it was far too accurate and painful about the deadly problem we have with extremist groups and terrorism here in the United States. Can you tell us a little bit about how that happened and what the results were?
Well, what had happened, as we know, for years after the 9/11 attacks with Mike Bloomberg and Ray Kelly, Mike Bloomberg as the mayor and Ray Kelly as the commissioner for NYPD, progress was made in fighting against terrorism. Studies were done. Cops were paired with intelligence analysts to kind of get the connection between intelligence and counterterrorism and law enforcement. And one of the things that came forth, a seminal report, was by Mitch Silber, who was at the time working as an intelligence director for the NYPD, and it was radicalization in the West. And basically what they did is they took a look at what are the phenomena, the parameters that are taking place when someone is radicalized. And we always talk about profiling. We talk about, well, you know, were they looking at race, ethnicity, things like that. And what they didn't, they looked for certain telltale signs that each one of the individuals who were involved in either a terrorist act or in plotting a terrorist act, and they found commonality. And that was a great report. And what happened is a couple of groups filed lawsuits against NYPD saying that they were singling out Muslim communities for spying on them and undue interference in their communities. And the lawsuits were progressing, but the lawsuits were actually losing ground as the city began to mount the defense and counter the arguments. And then what happened, all of a sudden, Mayor de Blasio met with different groups, ACLU, as well as members of CARE and other Islamic organizations, and basically threw up a white flag and said, we surrender, we'll do whatever you want, whatever your conditions are. And that's what they did. And one of the conditions was that they wanted this report removed from NYPD's website. They wanted this report removed from being used by any line officers, either in the intelligence division or in the counterterrorism division. And it was. It was basically whited out, removed.
Now, but the report didn't say, you know, accuse them of being terrorists for no reason other than the fact that they're Muslim. It targeted, as you said, specific activities like, oh, I don't know, growing a Salafist beard or starting to, you know, attend mosque very consistently and a lot more often. So those were behaviors. Those were not just specifically profiling someone because they were Muslim, because that didn't account for all Muslims. So where was the logic in that?
There wasn't any. In fact, the practices that the NYPD was using were standard police practices that had been used for years to fight organized crime. When the FBI and NYPD were looking at groups like the Mafia and John Gotti, and they did not go to Chinatown. They went to Italian neighborhoods. You know, we laugh at that because it was so, it's so simple. It makes sense. You learn what's going on in the community that's most vulnerable to those type of threats. So now all of a sudden we have, and we knew from 1993 on, when we had the blind Sheikh Abdel Rahman, El Said Nasser, and others who plotted the first World Trade Center bombing, we knew that they operated within the greater New York, New Jersey Muslim communities. So wouldn't it make sense to go to those communities and to gauge the level of activity that's going there? It's not profiling. It's just basic police practice.
And you do that, and if they've got a beef, you know, if CARE, you know, the Council on American Islamic Relations or other Muslim group have a beef, that beef shouldn't be, as you mentioned, with the police who are following absolutely common sense procedures. It should be with the Muslims who are doing these things in their communities, in their mosques. You know, it's not like these are fake Muslims. You know, it's not like they're being infiltrated by NYPD detectives who are pretending to be radicals. They've got radicals who cannot now be surveilled by NYPD detectives because of political correctness. It's absurd.
Yeah, that's true. Again, the use of undercover operatives that has worked in narcotics investigations, organized crime investigations, that's just a standard police practice. The problem with CARE is CARE does not exactly have a clear track record with law enforcement. They themselves were involved in Hamas fundraising and other issues where the FBI will not even recognize them as a certifying body for Muslim chaplains. So they're not coming from a stellar record.
They have even distributed flyers in the Muslim communities telling people not to cooperate with law enforcement because it demonizes the whole community, in essence giving cover then, you know, to the jihadists in their midst. So we've got de Blasio comes in and goes ahead and submits to the Islamists. And now we've got, essentially, we put Will, you know, to quote Andy McCarthy, who prosecuted the blind Sheikh, as you mentioned, and actually put him in prison, calls it willful blindness. So de Blasio did that again to all the folks in NY or in NYC who could use that those techniques and tactics and learn from that report. Now they're blindfolded and can't.
Yeah, and I can tell you that the rank and file in NYPD really respected that report and used it and some of the guidelines that it outlined. And they were somewhat disturbed that all of a sudden capitulating ground, you know, when you're winning the war on crime and you're winning the war on terrorism, then all of a sudden you're going to capitulate ground. That demoralizes the rank and file. And I think that's what this agreement has done to the NYPD and other law enforcement agencies that fight terrorism day in, day out.
So it essentially now they can use, you know, a lot of the law enforcement tactics and techniques, but they're supposed to pretend that Islamic terrorists have nothing to do with Islam. I thought Obama was gone. Is there a way, you know, somehow, I mean, does it take de Blasio leaving to get this changed? Is he just that powerful?
Yeah. And the critical issue about de Blasio, if it was any other mayor, we might be able to understand. But you remember de Blasio, right before President Obama was ending his term of office, he commuted the sentence of a terrorist, an FALN terrorist, Oscar Lopez Rivera. De Blasio got on the social media and extolled the praises of this man who was responsible for over 100 bombings, killing at least 4 people in New York City. Now, this is the person who's going to be the mayor of New York City, according to this agreement, is the one who's going to appoint the person who will oversee the NYPD intelligence division when it comes to investigating terrorism.
I think that might be a problem. You know, I have a feeling that might not be the guy I'd pick.
I'm going to, you know, who's he going to put in charge, you know? Yeah, it is really, if it was any other mayor, we might have a little bit more stability. But a man who sings the praises of a terrorist who has, as I said, killed at least 4 people in 100 bombings, that worries me. And it should worry every New Yorker.
Well, let's hope it worries them enough, and let's hope we don't have a terrorist act because of this, but that New Yorkers go ahead, and the next chance they have, let's put someone who takes the safety of New York City and the rest of us a lot more seriously than Mayor de Blasio does. Patrick Dunleavy, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Up next after the break, we will be talking with Kevin Freeman. This is Jim Hansen, and you're listening to Secure Freedom Radio.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. We're talking with Kevin Freeman, author of Game Plan, How to Protect Yourself from the Coming Cyber Economic Attack, founder of GlobalEconomicWarfare.com, as well as a senior fellow at the Center for Security Policy. Now, Kevin, the theme of today's show has kind of been the jousting Trump has been doing with the tyrants of the world, with the other major powers, the minor powers, the crazies, ISIS, all of it. And there is plenty going on. And he seems to have reasserted, if not U.S. dominance, at least U.S. power. But we also have some very significant issues economically that we have to take as seriously as the military or national security aspects of these interactions. And, you know, President Trump now has kind of changed his tune on whether or not China is a currency manipulator and threat. How do you think the economic aspect of this plays into our relations with, say, China and Russia and the other big actors?
Well, thanks, Jim. Basically, President Trump has taken the global geostrategic framework and filtered it through the art of the deal. He's taken his book and he is essentially, I'll call you a currency manipulator if that moves you the direction, or I'll say you're not one if that moves you the direction where I get you to achieve my objective. And he's playing that kind of art of the deal politics on the global stage, and he's apparently doing it very successfully, at least initially. We're seeing some positive movement from the Chinese and the Russians. You know, China and Russia are dependent on a successful global economy, and he knows that, and that gives him an enormous leverage to use with them.
So it seems that a lot of folks, and especially, you know, the Trump enemies, whether they're the never Trumpers or the entire institutional resistance left, seem to freak out every time he says something, which in some cases could be outrageous. But like you said, he uses hyperbolic rhetoric to achieve an aim. It's not that the literal words of a Trump tweet or a Trump statement are gospel and now the policy of the United States and will be followed to the letter. He's pushing somebody's button to get a reaction to move them, as you said, where he wants. And if that's working, then good on him, right?
Oh, I think so. It's, you know, it's the advantage of having a highly successful business person that gets deals done in the White House. Sometimes the decorum and so forth, just out of politeness, the United States has taken a back position. I remember President Obama bowing everywhere he went, taking a back position, and President Trump is doing what the basket of deplorables wanted him to do, and that's stand up for America first.
So now he had the Chinese president here, and obviously, you know, currency was the main thing. Given the primacy of economy for both us and them, is there a way to push at least some sort of peaceful coexistence forward where they're no longer acting in a predatory way and we can actually, you know, potentially be trading partners without being enemies?
Well, that's certainly a hope. I mean, in 1999, two senior colonels of the People's Liberation Army wrote a book titled Unrestricted Warfare, where they talked about economic warfare to bring down the United States and to advantage China. That only works if we're unaware of the game. And they've been effectively using those techniques for the past, well, since 1999, 18 years, against us, and we've acted ignorant that that was taking place. President Trump is saying, no, we're aware that you do these things, and we're willing to win this battle if we have to. And at that point, if you can't do it in the shadows, you can't do it. And so the Chinese have to back down, and their only hope for growing their economy is to be a good player on the global stage, to cooperate with the United States, to stop stealing intellectual property, to stop hacking everything that moves. So these are the kind of things that you have to expose this behavior, and you have to say that it has repercussions if you engage in it. And I think that's what President Trump's trying to get across. And he's now recognizing some of the complexities that China faces on their currency. They've actually been trying to strengthen their currency, and that's probably what was shown to the president is, look, we've made efforts because the yuan has strengthened against the dollar since the election and not weakened like most other currencies.
So now a part of this, again, is the idea that the Chinese have an interest in their economy not crashing. And, I mean, is it another piece of the puzzle that Trump obviously understands that a lot of, because he's a developer, they built entire cities in China that are empty. You know, a lot of the development, a lot of the growth that fueled the rise of China to its current perch was hollow in many ways. You know, is he pointing out that he understands that as well as what they're doing to us and says, don't make me push back too hard and collapse your house of cards?
He should be. They do have a house of cards. What we have in China are different groups that are vying for power. The People's Liberation Army, which is belligerent, they cannot be allowed to have power. Unfortunately, they own a lot of the businesses that we end up supporting. The Communist Party, which is just afraid of losing their heads in some kind of revolt or revolution, and then the business community. And that's the one that we can partner with, and that's the one that President Trump is going to reach out to and work with, is, you know, we can have a bright future together. Problem with the business community is they've also been infiltrated in part by the People's Liberation Army. So you've got to be very careful with whom you're dealing.
And I guess you probably have to make the assumption that they are all state organs in some way. I mean, there are individual pieces of the puzzle that are independent, but in the same way the Iranian Revolutionary Guard has businesses that they run, the People's Liberation Army has huge chunks of the Chinese economy that they use to consolidate their power base. Is there a way that Trump can do what you said, and even though it may advantage the People's Liberation Army in some way, try to pick and choose, you know, particular trading partners or people to work with who may be the least compromised?
I would hope so. And there are certainly some least compromised people that actually want to get in and profit, that their primary goal and motivation is to make money and to be a part of the global economy and so forth. There's a good segment in China that really believes that, but there is this nefarious other segment that's the PLA that's really trying for Chinese world domination, and that's a problem. It's something that very, very carefully you have to sort through that, and hopefully the president's getting good intelligence in that respect.
Well, let's take a quick look now to the other big dog, Russia. You know, obviously their economy has never taken off the way the Chinese has. Is the economic levers and incentives that he can use with China, are those also applicable in our relations with Russia?
With Russia, it all comes down to energy, at least at this point. Energy, energy, and energy. And the biggest lever that we have against Russia is developing our domestic energy capabilities and ensuring that we will no longer be held hostage by the Middle East, and that Europe does not have to be held hostage by the Russians for natural gas or for oil. And so that is the primary, most significant lever that we have. That's the one that Putin fears the most.
So essentially, I mean, is it possible we might have resources? Obviously, we keep discovering more and more resources here in the United States. Could we become an exporter at some point?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Now, to export, then you have to get into, and particularly natural gas, you have to get into LNG, and there are a whole host of other issues associated with that. But the United States has an energy capability that is second to none. Our technology has allowed us to continue to develop When we remove some of the onerous restrictions, regulations, federal land control, and so forth, we're an energy powerhouse.
Kevin Freeman, author of Game Plan, How to Protect Yourself from the Coming Cyber Economic Attack. Thanks for joining us. That's going to wrap up Secure Freedom Radio for today. We'll be back tomorrow with more ammunition for you in our war for the free world.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.